I can't believe how many families are suffering from this disease.
I now know that addiction is a family disease.
I thought no one in my family was an addict.
I still feel scared to death every day.
I don't know how to be a parent anymore.
These past few years have been absolutely the toughest time of my entire life.
My wife and I don't agree, and this is another big problem.
I don't want this to be a secret anymore. That makes it even worse.
If I have shame and guilt, how can my daughter ever get better?
Being with other parents is being with people who really get it, and that helps me a lot.
I've met some incredible people.
I can help other people, and I feel better every time I just talk about all this stuff with my group.
My life is turned upside down.
Even when my son isn't doing so well, we seem to be okay.
Talking with other parents helps me stay sane and not to feel so lost and alone.
There are good people, good places to get help for my daughter and for our entire family.
I have hope. I have to. I am not giving up my daughter.
I want to help others.
I've met some of the most special human beings. I'm very grateful.
Talking with the other parents is helping me to stay sane.
Hi, everybody. My name is Steve, and we have a 30-year-old son, our youngest, who's got quite a few years of recovery now. And it has been a remarkable experience to see him emerge. And it feels so different today. I don't even have the words to express it than it was those frightening years, which seem like a long time ago, sometimes, and a moment ago during other times. But it is so very nice to be able to be with all of you this evening.
Hi, everybody. I'm Vee. Yes, we have two boys, and our youngest is in recovery and living a pretty good life right now. And I'm very grateful. I made the decision to be with you all tonight and to get to know you before tonight and to have you in my life. So it's great to see everybody.
Hi, I'm Jill. I have a 26-year-old son who is an alcoholic. He was in long-term recovery for 16 months. He is actually coming up on a little over 3.5 years of his sobriety. And he's been doing incredibly well. Recently, he's been going through some employment changes and definitely he's testing his sobriety, but he is absolutely reaching out to his support network. And that to me is just fantastic to see. Really happy to be here tonight.
Hi, everybody. I'm Steven, and I'm the father of 5 children, the youngest of whom is in remission from a very serious alcohol use disorder. He is coming up on, I can't even believe it, coming up on 7 years of sobriety. He got sober as a teenager, as you guys know. And I'm really excited to be here tonight with all of you talk about these important issues that we've been dealing with for all these years.
I am Kate. I'm really glad to be here tonight. I'm the mother of 3 sons, one of whom is 19 years sober from an alcohol use disorder. And Jeff and I are the main supports of our 35-year-old niece, who's in recovery from a heroin addiction. And has found alcohol. So she's been in a very fragile recovery state over the last 2 years, and I need this support.
Hi, I'm Jess. I'm the husband of Kate, my child bride. So I have the same qualifiers, as they say. And, it's a challenge that we have others that are not in recovery. They're also a challenge. That's a different issue. And we see a lot of the stuff that goes on. And you want to be involved in this stuff because you never know when you're going to need a lot of support. Glad to be here.
Good evening. My name is Jay. I have 2 children, both in recovery. One is 27. One is soon to be 29. both around 5 to 5.5 years. Long journey, but I've been attending parent support groups for about a dozen years now, pretty religiously. I find them to be incredibly helpful. And occasionally I get to help others, which feels good also. Look forward to tonight.
I am Mark. As the group knows, I need support tremendously right now. 6 months ago, I lost my oldest daughter, and not from drugs, from natural causes. And my daughter, who's in recovery for 6.5 years now, turned 28 yesterday. And she has made a commitment to her memory of her sister to stay sober forever. Let's hope she can. And again, thank you guys for being there for me. And I'm sorry for crying, but it's been a rough go.
Good evening, folks. My name is Reverend Jack, and I know several of you, I feel reasonably well, but a couple of you are brand new to me, and so it's nice to make your acquaintance. And I've been really privileged to be invited tonight to join the conversation, and given the liberty of just a slightly longer personal introduction. So I'm a person in longer-term recovery, I say longer-term, like decades, and I began my recovery by identifying as an atheist, but in a long story we won't have time to go into, I eventually went to seminary and became ordained. And for a period of time, I served as a pastor of churches, but all the while I was very active in my recovery program. And then in 2008, I was recruited to become a chaplain in an addiction treatment center called Karen. And I've been serving as the lead chaplain at Karen, especially in the last several years, when our iconic and much loved previous spiritual leader retired and then passed away. So my work day involves helping individuals who are coming into residential addiction treatment. And then also have a lot of points of intersection with families whose loved ones are in our care. And one of the other big things I'm often known for is being the principal presider of this really unique thing called the Karen Chapel Service, which takes place every Sunday. And it's a interfaith or multi-faith celebration of spirituality and recovery. And we draw people from actually far and wide. Now post-COVID, we're happy to be able to welcome visitors again to the chapel service. And that's probably one of the most exciting and fun parts of my day-to-day work life. So, I've been a guest of the podcast before, and I'm really grateful to be back.
Well, thank you, Father Jack. It's awesome to see you again. I remember the last time we got together, and it was just an incredible night. And so I'm really excited for tonight as well. Before I start on our topic, I just want to say, Mark, I love you, brother. And, you know, big hugs from me, and your strength is just beyond belief. So hang in there, and, you know, we got you. We love you.
Thank you. Same.
So tonight's topic is our decisions. And, you know, I thought about the topic, and two things jumped into my head immediately. The first one was the title, Our Decisions. For the longest time in my life, you know, decisions were my decisions. I made decisions. I felt really good with my process. I felt like very confident in my decision making. And then I ran into this disease called addiction. And to say that my decision making wasn't adequate is being very generous to me and, you know, my capabilities. I was just a complete mess. And what I learned over the process was that our decisions was exactly what it needed to be. First, my wife and I needed to be on the same page. That was not simple. We did not start in the same place. And decisions that were going to be effective were not going to work unless my wife and I were on the same page. The second thing, which seems really obvious now, but that we needed expert advice. You know, somehow I thought that I could, you know, somehow make good decisions around this disease of addiction without clinical help, without professional help. And that was just pure malarkey. There was no way that I was capable. And then the third thing, which is kind of the secret sauce to making decisions, was having support and having people like all of you around to support the decisions that I made. And, you know, to really help me get over the hump on making the really hard ones. So that was the first thing, you know, is really this whole notion of our decisions. The second thing that was really difficult about decisions was the pushback, the really aggressive pushback, particularly early on of my son. And I remember a number of events. First one was when he was suffering from very severe depression. We committed him to a 1 week stay in a psych ward, not a pleasant thing for him by any stretch. But when we went to visit, I remember him refusing to even look at me. I could see the anger just seething through his entire body that we had done what we had done, which was the right decision. When he got out, we had a choice of outpatient treatment or intensive outpatient treatment. We chose intensive outpatient treatment. And that was another moment. I went upstairs to tell him our decision, and he sent me out of his room. He locked the door. He turned on the shower. So we were effectively couldn't really hear what was going on, couldn't see what was going on. And he announced to me that I was the reason for his depression. So it just got me back on my heels. It got me in a position where, you know, I just had no confidence in decision making. And I was really questioning this decision, which was the correct decision. And so, you know, and there were a number of other events, you know, where he disowned me as his father. And what I can say is, along the way, there are some really, really big decisions. And the notion of doing it alone was absolutely the wrong choice. So having a team and making our decisions was really important. And also being ready for the pushback, I think, was a really, really big deal. And something that when I think about decisions, those are the two things that I think about.
You know, I heard what you were saying, Steve, and it made me think about one of the most frustrating parts of all this are the decisions that I didn't get to make, and the frustration of thinking I was doing everything right, talking it over with Steve and speaking to professionals and this and that, and then only to find that other decisions were being made by my son, who was really the one in the driver's seat to make a difference. And that frustration, I honestly haven't thought about until you started talking. You know, that feeling of just being, you know, with your hands tied behind your back because of the decisions that were out of my control and out of my hands. And, you know, it goes back to control. You know, I talk about that a lot, and I really I've come to realize how much of this has to do with my belief that I could control things. If I just figured out the right answer, the right choice, the right decision, the right way to go, that this would all turn out a certain way. And it's a little of that and a little not of that. So anyway, thanks for opening us up. That was really a good start.
When I first heard that we were going to have a topic on our decisions, the first thing that came to my mind is my non-decisions, the decisions that I didn't make that I probably should have made. And those were made or not made out of total ignorance and prior to learning that I was powerless over the disease that my children were suffering from. The more I thought about it, I started thinking about the decisions that I made and sort of what Steve said at the beginning. I was raised by an entrepreneur. Entrepreneurs make decisions and live by them. And that's how I ran my life. And boy, it came to a screeching halt when I made a lot of decisions and I didn't want to live with them because they were not the right ones. And I look forward to discussing this further this evening, but I think it's decisions and non-decisions that affected me during the difficult times with my children.
you know, when I think about the topic of decisions, what comes to my mind immediately are the decisions I've made to protect myself. When my son was in long-term recovery, when he first got in there, he was beyond angry. The phone calls that we got from him were just venomous. He was just blaming us for everything. And I made a decision to basically give him permission to not be in touch with us. And that actually started about 7 months of no communication. I didn't realize it at the time because I didn't really have the recovery language to explain it. But I made that decision because those phone calls and that anger were just too much for me to handle. I was dealing with a lot of trauma. And by making that decision to protect myself, it gave me the space to work on myself. I realize it now that it was a good decision to make, but it came on me in an instant. It wasn't something that I hemmed and hawed about. It was something that I just made a split second decision and wrote him a letter and said, this isn't working. And I'm really grateful that I did that. And I can now look back and realize that it was a decision I made to keep myself safe.
You know, my wife and I were lucky in terms of decision-making. Stephen had pointed out in the beginning about having to try to coordinate with a spouse. And most, not all, but most child-rearing things, my wife and I were pretty much in tune with all along. You know, there were some details that were different. The first time she kicked one of our kids out of the house, which was related to drinking. And I wasn't so much objecting to that, but she should have asked me first. But, you know, kicking him out made a certain amount of sense. But as we got into the more heavy duty stuff, to some extent with him and more so with our niece, so many of the decisions, as Stephen said, we really needed experts, things that were intuitively obvious to me that would work with a kid and that were appropriate for your child, would not going to work with an addict. You know, there were things that sometimes I'd hear the professional say, well, you know, that's a problem. You shouldn't do that. And my first reaction would be, what's the matter with this guy? Of course you should do that. And then he'd explain why and what an addict is going to do and how they're going to, you know, react to what you've done. You know, giving your child money for food can be bad. Normally you'd say, you always would give your child money for food. Of course you would. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily, you know, there's so many things that were counterintuitive. And I, you know, we pretty quickly, started to use the really just ask everything from the experts. And gee, what does such and such say? What does the treatment team say? And not to use our initial reactions at all, or even a considered response unless we'd gotten it from the experts and learn from them. One of the first things, you don't have to make an immediate decision. I have to think about it. I'll get back to you. And then talk to the treatment team or talk to whoever the resources were. And so often what they had to say was different from what would have made perfect sense to me before. And it made so much of a difference. It was so helpful to use the professionals. You know, they make mistakes like everybody else, but, you know, their best thinking is a heck of a lot better than my worst thinking.
Jeff and Jill were each saying things that I was thinking about. And I have the privilege of trying to sort of come alongside both the suffering use disorder patient and the family members and speak into the morass of complexity of decision making. And what I was thinking about, you know, Jill talked about how all of a sudden this quandary crystallized in an action. And I think there's something right, really quite mysterious about how human beings make decisions. And there's a falsity that we get entrapped with because of the beauty of language. So language sounds like all decisions have a yes or no, this kind of clean binary aspect. But what I was thinking about is the thing I watch often is that we have like incubation process in which we have to weigh a variety of different choices. So it's rarely a clean yes or no. And you know, even if it's kicking out of the house, it's on what terms and how long and, you know, are there conditions or not? So there's a complexity to this subject that we're talking about that isn't avoidable. And part of the richness of it once I've spent a lot of time, I was telling Steve before, when we were talking about me having a chance to be here tonight, was that as a spiritual practitioner and practical theologian, the question of spiritual discernment is one that many people have written about. And it's a great topic because it's so darn difficult. And this is where I think that community and outside voices help us weigh the deliberation of the mess of things that are all possible, including what Jay said, which is inaction, you know, and so not executing on a plan is a decision, and waiting is a decision. And in fact, waiting is often the decision that parents are making constantly and for unbelievable amounts of time. And those of us who love the parents are like frustrated, but don't know what to do because we have to let other people sort of sit there in the misery of their suffering. And, you know, you want to say, like, for God's sake, do something. But, you know, I think that's one of the things I've realized is that I can never make somebody do something. They have to, like, eventually come to their own sort of clarity about the moment. So I love this subject, and I think it's made all the more clear, I guess, when we realize it isn't clear and that the muddiness is part of it. So that's my thought.
So when I realized that my daughter was an active heroin addict, I too was an addict. So I was in denial about myself and obviously about her. To compound matters, and my life is complicated, I was also going through a divorce at the time. So my wife had one set of decisions she wanted to make, and I had others. And in retrospect, I must admit she was right more than I was. And I'm glad we went with her, because today my daughter is sober for 6.5 years. Without support groups, I wouldn't have known how to make the right decision. Everybody thinks they know everything, but this is a topic that nobody's ever taught. You never, ever can learn enough of it. And the simple fact that I went to groups just like this one allowed me to learn how to make the right decision, which I was totally not capable of for a long, long time. So I thank my therapists, my groups, my friends who have helped me. And it's pretty substantial to do the right thing. And I thought I was, and I really was not.
So I just want to say that I made really terrific decisions. I was right. I was right most of the time, okay? Because I had more life experience, and it was my kid, and I had the benefit of higher education and disposable income, and I could write emails and send texts and send more emails and more texts, and I was going to make it happen. I knew what to do. Somehow that did not filter through in the manner to which I thought it should be accepted. And it was disappointing, quite frankly, that I had decided something that I was convinced was the right thing, and other people were not following through the decision I had made. And this got gnarly because it was leading to this whole business, which I was very uncomfortable about how I was powerless over certain things. Another thing I didn't like very much and wasn't too happy about. So it turned out that little by little, turns out they weren't all my decisions to make. And that was a whole new territory that the papa, the father, the parent, the payer, the mature one who thought he was in charge and could fix it, was undermined. So it was only when little by little, upon reflection, I realized that I had to not only back off, I had to way move in a different way about who was going to decide what, and that the pivotal player wasn't me. And that was a life-changing, life-demanding change that caused me years of thinking and years of refining. And it was a whole lot more than just taking my hands off the wheel, okay? It was reorienting my brain to what my role was as a parent, as a loving parent, as a supportive parent, and a transformation of my understanding of my parenting.
I just wanted to hop on what Mark mentioned about support. I think the smartest decision I made was to walk into that parent support group the first time, was to go to the family education at Karen that weekend where I learned about this disease. I was so ignorant and so afraid. And I can still remember that fear, that first night walking into a group of strangers and using the word heroin. And actually, Steve, you said, oh, yeah. And it was like, oh, I could remember breathing. I remember the breath I took at that moment. And then I said, Jeff, you got to come with me. You know, it was, you know, the education has made an enormous difference for me. It gives me the endurance I need to make it through the day. It helps me be, you know, I'm a pretty emotional, can be an irrational gal. And I will tell you, the education, you know, has me think about what I'm doing and why I'm doing it and what the action is. And without all of you saying, and how do you think that's going to work out for you, Kate? You know, what would, you know, it's other people's advice and journeys that helps me figure out what's best for me and for our family and for our niece. It's been a beautiful thing.
You know, the word counterintuitive came up a couple times this evening. I think Reverend Jack might have mentioned it. How can you make appropriate decisions when everything is counterintuitive? And if you didn't have any experience, who would have thought that the best decision that my wife and I made may have been the one that said, you can no longer come home? Who would think that? You know, we had put him in. We had sent him to 20 to 25 different programs. Some of them were the same. He went multiple times. And I remember having a discussion which turned a bit heated from an owner of one of the places when I said, well, when he got kicked out and we were going to find another place. And I was told, no more. You can't do that. I said, I can't let him go. He needs medicine. He won't survive. And the person I was speaking to raised his voice and then hung up the phone on me. There's an expert that knew something, and I'm wondering, he must be nuts. And then one more time, we found him another place. And this time we listened and we said no more. If you do not successfully complete the program, we are no longer going to be able to support you. And he was homeless for 4.5 years. The good news is he survived, which I didn't think he would. And he's doing great. So all visits to those 20 to 25 places were worthwhile. He learned it, and he's been using it for 5 years now. But it's counterintuitive. Until I've been through it, how could I have known that you're supposed to tell a sick person that you need to live outside and you'll get all better by doing that? Crazy. Of course, I never thought it was going to be 4.5 years, but here we are.
Kate, you said something, Kate, about the power of recovery and, you know, how recovery has changed, I'm paraphrasing you, but sort of has changed your thought process. One of the biggest things I've learned from being in my own recovery is how to wait when I have a decision to make. How to say the words, I'll think that over, or let me get back to you about that. I think for many, many, many years, I made decisions based on emotion were based on wanting to not let my child be uncomfortable, thinking I was doing, sort of as Steve was saying, all the right things. I had all the answers because I was the parent. And I was moving obstacles out of his way and I was preventing him from being uncomfortable. And suddenly I have this recovery language and I'm being told that I have to let him be uncomfortable and that I don't have to give him an answer right away if he asks for something, that I have a decision to make. And it initially was really challenging to live that way because I just wanted to make my child happy and have him like me. And I thought that by not giving him what he wanted and by saying, I need to think about that for a little while, that I was going to lose my son. But I had kind of already lost him to alcohol. So what did I have to lose? And, you know, I listened to the experts and it worked.
These counterintuitive choices to either not act immediately or to set boundaries with regards to money and housing and treatment and time are all part of like the thing that is in my mind is that even the word counterintuitive doesn't maybe capture how viscerally there is a compulsion in those of us who are in these caring relationships like parenting or uncle or grandparent or adult, but child of an addicted senior. There's a reason why the Al-Anon and other family groups have formed, because it is as powerful a force as the addict is in their need to use, is this feeling I must intervene. And I cannot refuse care or a home or a bed to my child. I cannot say no, you know, when they're asking for help. And this dance emerges of, you know, and the terms like enabling are helpful and illuminating, but it's so painful to hear a person hang up on the phone when, you know, they're trying to tell me I should do something that everything in me, every part of me feels I can't make that decision to enforce a boundary. And one of the things that's tremendously difficult about this too is the evolution of that, of those dynamics and relationships, because if I set a boundary and then I'm unable to stick to it, then I've written a permission slip for the next attempt to establish a boundary becomes all the more complex and difficult. So it not only is it very difficult to enact these decisions, but then to remain faithful to them and to allow ourselves to believe that we are loving in a new way and giving time a chance. I happen to know a little bit more of Jay's story than some of you others. And I every time he talks about the period of time that his son is in recovery, it brings tears to my eyes, because I would testify to that. In me, it's a miraculous event. And it required exactly this kind of willingness to hold to the course that was established and continue to say no against all odds. Thanks.
Yeah. You know, your point, Jack, is right. I've come to feel about this. Any one decision, it's rare that any one decision makes that big a difference. The decision making, what you're really doing or what I'm doing, is going down, deciding what path to go down. How do I approach this? What am I going to do so that hopefully the different decisions, you know, responding to attacks or to requests or to how you deal with problems when they come up, it's sort of consistent and gets me to where I think I want to go, which hopefully will have my qualifier end up where he or she is, where it's healthy for them. So any one decision doesn't necessarily matter that much, but I should have some consistency. Don't, doing it the same way. Where am I, you know, am I, if I set boundaries, I've got to stick with them, or else I've taught that person to ignore the boundaries and to fight back. That I need to be consistent. And that's one of the reasons to go to the parent groups and listen to what people say they're doing and what seems to be working and not working for them. And even though all the situations are different, what works for, you know, Jay's kid clearly is not going to necessarily work for somebody else and vice versa. But you start to get a feel for what things make sense and what don't make sense and when you should be asking the questions. And I sort of get reinforced, okay, this is the right way to do it and just continue doing this. And it doesn't matter if I've made a mistake in one case or another, as long as I'm heading in the right direction, stepping a little bit off the path doesn't matter. Couldn't revert.
Hey, Jeff, I just want to make a comment. I don't mean to be rude, but I might correct you. What works for other kids didn't work for my son. It's just slight difference in the way it was said, but we tried to do a lot of things that other people were doing and it wasn't working.
So you tried, Jay, I believe that the record shows you tried to do everything that everyone was doing.
It seemed like a lot. So I think what you're describing, you know, Jeff, really is the process. And, you know, really, I mean, as we're talking, you know, Jeff, you talked about counterintuitive decision making, you know, multiple people have. Reverend Jack, you talked about muddiness, right? Like, it's not easy. You know, it's not just yes or no. There's pushback. I think it was Jill, you were talking about, you know, really awful pushback. And so, you know, this is all, you know, gets us to what the value is of the team, because as Jeff describes it, you know, in my life, that's where it took a while. My head was spinning for a long time, but it got me to the point where I started to understand the language. I started to understand the concepts. I started to understand the counterintuitive decisions actually made sense. And, you know, that the pushback was just a tool that my son was using to continue doing what he wanted to do. And where I want to kind of get to in this share is what Reverend Jack said, which is loving in a new way. There was a certain way that I thought I was supposed to support my kid. But, you know, and I had one of those moments. The moment was his senior year of high school. We had set a boundary or a rule that if he drank again, we were potentially going to send him away to residential treatment. Fall of his senior year, captain of the soccer team, you know, a million friends. It was going to be devastating for him. And he disowned me. And I looked at him and I got to the point that Reverend Jack was talking about. And I said to him, I have never been more of a parent than I am being at this exact moment. Because if I had just caved and, you know, and was no longer being the parent that I needed to be, that was, he would have liked that a lot more, but it was the wrong answer for where we were in that moment. He had to believe that if I said something, I meant it. And even if he came after me with disowning me as his child, you know, disowning me as his father. And so to me, it's exactly what you said, Reverend Jack. I was loving him in a way that I, 6 months earlier, could never have anticipated.
In the beginning, I didn't realize that all the decisions had such consequences. I wanted to be her friend, not her father. Like Jill said, you become a friend to her, and then you lose grasp a little bit of what they respect and listen to, and it becomes a joke almost. But the best decision was my going to the support group, because it taught me everything counterintuitive. It's, you have to be hard. You have to be tough. You have to. And, you know, I was one who had issues. I thought I knew everything. I knew nothing. And to hear from other parents, from the group leader, it just opened your eyes to say, you know, each one of these kids has a different issue and yet they have to be dealt even though they're different issues, they still have to be dealt tough and they have to be dealt the same way. And, you know, these support groups have helped me through my recent grief. It's taught me a whole different way. I don't think I would have survived my daughter's passing without these support groups. It's every decision has consequences. And that's something I didn't realize at first. And every day now I do.
So Stephen, for me, loving in a new way, as Reverend Jack talked about, was very uncomfortable, right? So Jill, not only was my qualifier uncomfortable in treatment, I was uncomfortable in learning a new way of living. I had to get, and I'm still very uncomfortable with honest conversations. There was a lot of eggshell walking that went on in our house, and getting honest was very uncomfortable, but it was loving, you know. And I spend a lot of time thinking about, you know, when I'm approaching a decision, what is the loving thing here? And not loving in that emotional, you know, give me a little hug kind of a way, but loving in the terms of, you know, really spiritually supportive, you know, wanting the best for somebody all the time. And, you know, that loving decision-making is really hard work for me, you know, because I'm thinking very differently in this phase of my recovery than I've ever thought before. And it's been very uncomfortable to critique myself and be honest about who I am and my humanity and where I fall short and making my amends and apologizing. And all of that stuff is such hard work, but so fruitful.
So I think most of you are probably aware that during the past week, a son of one of our parents, our fellow parents from parent support group meeting, lost that battle. And I can't help but thinking that one of the issues about decisions is the painful fear connected. Once I came to understand about this terrible disease and the consequences of it, and then it was so much tougher to even say what I thought should be done by me or someone else, because I came to realize that sometimes these are life and death decisions. And they're not just about being the papa know-it-all who can say, of course, you got to go to school and you can't drop out and no, you can't have a car and you shouldn't be smoking weed and your friends. And that it's about the heaviest duty shit there is. And the consequences of these decisions are incredibly burdensome when you take them on alone, when you feel you're alone. And we always say to people, you know, you're not alone. But sometimes you feel alone. You feel really alone. And it just strikes me that what I thought I knew the answer to in the beginning and could easily say, here's the decision, so to speak, or what amounted to a decision. Later on, not that long after, I came to realize it was tough to make a decision once I knew a little bit more. And it was frightening to maybe make a decision, and that you needed a whole lot of people to help you get through the toughest of the days on this so-called journey.
Steve really got my heart by talking about the gravitas of the subject matter and a principle that is operative in the work world that I circulate in is expressed in this axiom, which is I'm responsible for the intervention and not the outcome. And it's been tremendously helpful for me, because sometimes either in my role with a patient or in watching the family's role with their loved one, or watching the loved one, and there is a all that stuff activates in me. I want to control. I want to be able to push towards a eventual outcome. And I have no way of knowing when people leave our care. I have no way of knowing if they're going to be the one. One of my roles at Karen is to contact family members when this ultimate tragedy happens of a death from an alumnus of our programming. And that's been a painful and powerful education for me to have those conversations. And what has become so clear to me is that the Lone Ranger, who is very dug in and must parent from their conviction about how they have to do it, and is at much greater risk in a future outcome that's tragic, and that a person who can find the humility to put themselves in a stream and become a part of an hour decision can find a measure of comfort in this notion that what they did was attempt to. The other axiom that we use all the time is to encourage the parents and loved ones to support recovery as this kind of basic principle, and be careful to not support return to use. So that's a helpful, like, guiding GPS marker, like, is to ask yourself the question, as I'm about to initiate this action, is it one that moves in the direction of supporting sustained abstinence, or is it a decision that moves in the direction of permitting sort of return to use? And these things are so important, but it's the outcomes that we don't even like to think about are very real possibilities. And we have better insurance when we enter into this collective deliberative process and allow others to help shape our decision-making. That's my thought.
Stephen, I'm thinking back to what you were saying before about that moment you were a parent, you know, that hard decision that you needed to make. And in listening to that, I was immediately brought back to my son's bedroom, smelling like whiskey and urine and vomit. And we're standing around his bed and we're doing this intervention. And we are basically saying to him, you are going into treatment, or you are going on the streets to be homeless. And it was a decision that my husband and I had come to, that we knew these were the only two options. And we had never been the kind of parents who, you know, did that tough love, and we never really believed in a lot of consequences or punishments for behavior. But this was different. And it did feel so counterintuitive, because this isn't how I had been parenting him for 20 some odd years. And we were suddenly telling him, you know, you can't live in our house anymore. Whatever choice you decide to make, whether you go on your own or whether you're in treatment, you can't be in our house anymore. And it was probably the hardest parenting decision I have ever made in my life, because it didn't feel like I was being a parent at the time. I realize now that I was, and I realize now that was exactly what was needed. But boy, did that really feel shitty at the time.
Yeah, I'll tell you, when my son disowned me, or said he was going to disown me, it was only because I had gone to probably 6 or 7 months of parent support group meetings that I could say what I said to him and really feel it in my heart, that I was standing tall on a decision. We actually hadn't made the decision. I said, if that's what they recommend, that's what we're doing. But you know, that was only because I had the support, really. I would like to claim some credit for that, but I really owe it to the people, who the clinicians and the experienced parents who were there literally by my side at that moment.
I appreciate what you said about making a decision that supports recovery or maybe does not. And I thought about it when you were speaking as well, Jill, because those difficult decisions along the way, I remember a period of time where my son was living on his own and was not in a program and there wasn't a team to fall back on. And the decision was about helping him financially. And that for me was very, very, very painful. Because the things he was asking for, and I think you mentioned it earlier, Reverend Jack, but the things he was asking for were, you know, groceries and food and the electric bill and whatever, things that it is possible for me to think that he should live without, that his discomfort, and if only he would be a little more comfortable and a little more well-fed and went to the gym, then maybe he'd embrace recovery more. And I hear it now as being a ridiculous notion. And I came to realize that any amount of financial help that I gave him was going straight towards the opposite of recovery, by making it possible for him to have, you know, some extra income to do other, you know. So it was very, very, very painful to sort of withhold, you know, that as a parent for me.
You know, and that sort of support recovery mode, our first family therapist, when our son was getting sober, basically said, "What's the goal?" I said, "What do you mean, what's the goal? You know, get him sober, get him launched." And she said, you have to agree on the goal. Not everybody has the same goal. And then she said, "I want you to think, you know, you and Jeff to think about every action you take. Is it positive to the goal? Is it negative to the goal? Or is it neutral to the goal? And if it's negative and neutral, maybe that's not an action you should be taking." And, you know, this is 19 years ago. This is pre-support groups. I mean, you know, there was some Al-Anon around, but not much. And I will tell you, that piece of advice, that suggestion is still a part of our vocabulary today. You know, I try and think about that. I use it at work. A lot of the tools that I've learned in recovery, I use in my life every day, and they're beautiful tools. You know, Reverend Jack, you mentioned principles. What are my principles? What are the principles upon which I stand, and how do I live them out? And all of this is just so important to me. And that's been a decision I've made, is, you know, in getting this support.
So this is such an awesome topic, you know, supporting recovery, not supporting unhealthy behaviors. You know, this whole thing that you were talking about, the money, it is complicated, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's not actually a behavior on their part. It could create a positive or negative behavior. But the way I think about it is that I'm here to support anything that's a healthy behavior and not support anything that's an unhealthy behavior. And, you know, as we've been talking through this meeting, we've been talking about the really hard part, you know, the hard parts, the counterintuitive stuff, the saying no, the setting boundaries. But this other side, supporting recovery, is actually intuitive to all of us. We love supporting our kids. We love, like, congratulating them. Yet, you know, when you're in the throes of all this negative stuff, I found that I wasn't as, you know, ebullient, as, you know, supportive, as, you know, positive. And I should have been singing from, you know, the mountaintops when he did things like go to the gym, like, you know, do positive, healthy things. And I think that, you know, for me going through the process, it was a missed opportunity. Because the other stuff sucks. It's hard. It's counterintuitive. I didn't want to do it, right? But it had to be done as an adult parent. But the supporting the positive behaviors as he was coming out of all the negative behaviors and rebuilding his life, that's the part that I think I underinvested in. And, you know, it was a missed opportunity as a parent. And it's easy for parents because, you know, I felt like
That's natural for me. That feels good. Today, every time I say goodbye to my daughter on the phone conversation, I tell her I'm proud of you and I love you. Mm-hmm. And I never told her I was proud of her until 6 years ago when she got sober. And I think that makes such a difference to say those couple of words to her. It's changed a lot of our dynamic.
Mm-hmm. I love what Stephen just said. One of the things I enjoy thinking about, we talked about process earlier, but it's like this is an epic journey. And I had a mentor earlier in my life. And I think what Stephen was said about being ebullient and affirmative towards our qualifier, we should also be ebullient and celebratory for ourselves. So, my mentor used to say, celebrate every victory. When you're working towards a far off horizon, there are going to be victories and disappointments along the way. And part of the art of it that can keep you engaged is to be really celebrate. So when, you know, you decide to support a move towards treatment or care or health or wellness or whatever, and it's accepted, you know, not only praise and celebrate the person who's undertaking the journey, but pat yourself on the back, you know, like, yay, I'm doing the right thing. And I think that finding whatever it is to be joyous about is really wise, because these are just tough parts of the journey of life.
So there are days when there's nothing to really look forward to. And then there are days when you have your parent support group meeting and you look forward to it because it feels so damn good. And who could imagine that this is where it was going to go, that this is where we were going to be. Zoom has brought us together, and the pandemic will not keep us apart. So thank you, everybody. It is always so good to be together.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good to see everyone.
This is a podcast by parents for parents.
We are not professionals, but parents offering our own experiences with the hope that it might help others.
We are not experts, and our words are our own, with views not necessarily shared by care and treatment centers.
Nothing that we offer in our comments should be considered instructional or diagnostic.
Definitely not treatment.
And it is not specific to any particular person, just our general thoughts based upon our own experiences with our family members.
Please visit, call, consult with healthcare professionals, your doctor, and other qualified specialists.
And do not change what your healthcare professional advises based upon anything you heard a parent say in this podcast.
We are not addiction experts.
Just parents sharing our personal experiences with other parents.